I'm Maddie Myers.
I'm Kirk Hamilton.
And I'm Jason Schreier. And hello.
Hi.
Hello. It's
a
us.
A monthly Beans cast.
Yes.
We are here.
Hello, Beans cast listeners. Hello, Maximum Fun members.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for supporting the show. We much appreciate it. The show would not be possible without
or
all of
supporting
you.
Some other show.
That's true. Thank you for supporting Maximum Fun, a wonderful place. On a terrible internet.
A lovely, lovely network full of lovely podcasters.
And perhaps you're a person who watched every episode of the television show Mythic Quest, and you want to hear what three huge gamers, huge nerds, just the coolest trio in the world want to say about it. Because that's what we did. We watched every episode of this show. Pretty much as it was coming out, I think we all kept up with this one.
For the most part, yeah.
Had a lot of fun with it. This is an Apple TV Plus show. The first season all came out on one day, February 7th, 2020, which I was actually shocked when I saw that date. I was like, really? I feel like that was a lifetime ago. And that was like before quarantine happened. But like in my head, I don't even associate it with that. And then, of course, shortly after that, the actors all recorded on their iPhones, I think, mostly an episode called Quarantine that came out on May 20th, 2020, about the idea of being in a video game studio working in quarantine, since this is a show about a video game studio. And then in April 2021, they put out another one-shot episode called Everlight about a LARP. COVID is kind of mentioned in that one, and then it's almost completely forgotten for season two, which came out in May and June of 2021. I actually wonder if maybe they did that because they weren't sure what was going to happen with the vaccine and stuff. So they were like, let's just write the show as though everything's fine. I don't know. I have not personally asked Charlie Day, Megan Gantz, and Rob McElhenney what happened in terms of the writing of the show. So I don't know if that's why, but those are the three people who wrote and created the show. Over to you, Jason.
But CW is like on camera most of the time.
He is, which is fun.
Presumably because he's older and so he doesn't want to be.
But almost every single other employee of this game studio is at the office, which what does that tell you about the state of game studios?
Well, AAA game studios.
I don't know if that's intended as commentary, but yeah.
Well, it's funny because it's based on Ubisoft, and Ubisoft is like their plan as of right now. Well, everyone's changed from the fall, but their plan is like flex working schedule, but like very few people can actually work remotely. So they will have people in the office.
Do you think it's based on Ubisoft?
Yeah. Let's just start there.
Okay. So first of all, this show is created in conjunction with Ubisoft. Ubisoft is like heavily involved with the show. They've lended a lot of their game footage to the show, like
they
Assassin's
have.
Creed and stuff.
Yeah.
Mythic Quest is basically a mashup of Assassin's Creed and For Honor, at least in the first season. And then it gets some like Horizon Zero Dawn.
And then they made their own stuff that's like World of Warcraft style.
Yes.
But most importantly, they mention Montreal, like their corporate owners
they
in
do.
Montreal.
You're right.
And that is Ubisoft.
Yeah, but I feel like the game...
I guess technically that would be Paris, but
the
still.
The game itself feels so much like World of Warcraft and Fortnite, though, in terms of like the kind of game it is and how they talk about
it. I'm not saying that this is actually meant to be a Ubisoft studio. I'm saying that like if you're making any parallels, like Ubisoft is the closest because they were so heavily involved with it all.
It is and it isn't. I mean, I was thinking about the Activision Blizzard lawsuit a lot while watching this, and I kind of wished I weren't. Like, if anything, I would like to be able to remove that memory from my brain when I'm watching a funny sitcom with like, you know, jokes about sex and stuff. And I'm like, this is a workplace. How dare you? And I'm like, God, I need to just enjoy this sitcom. But that did hang heavy on my heart.
But Ubisoft, I mean, Ubisoft is like that.
Oh, I know. Like it's not like Ubisoft. I know.
Well, so the other thing that I think is similar to Ubisoft, and this makes for a good springboard to discussing what actually matters in the show, is that Ubisoft is a very creative director-centric culture, and it's like, you have the creative director, and it's always he, sets the tone for the game, and everyone is expected to follow the auteur's whims, and that is kind of Ubisoft. It's also very AAA industry as a whole, but it's pretty Ubisoft. So there are a lot of cultural things that are very similar to Ubisoft.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I really just asked the question, do you really think it's Ubisoft? Because it's interesting to think what studio could have inspired the studio that makes Mythic Quest, primarily because they're right. Yeah. It's intended to be this sort of, you know, it is a nameless studio that could be any studio. So it has these individual elements that you've seen time and time again. And I think in the recent reporting, you know, on plenty of game studios, it's like the narrative of the auteur is part of it, but also the founder. And I think that that's an important part of Mythic Quest is that Ian, who, Rob McElhenney's character, is the guy who created the game. And then presumably, and they don't get into this, but I guess he created the game and they got pretty big and then they were acquired by Montreal. So there's like a bigger company that owns
them.
No,
so they talk about this at the end of Dark Quiet Death. He actually pitches the game to Montreal. So presumably Montreal, they became the publisher. And then it's not clear if it's like an indie studio or if it's owned by Montreal. But like we know Montreal has always been funding this game.
So I guess he came in and pitched the thing to them. So there's also that kind of, he is the creative director. So it's a creative director centric culture, but also he is the guy who created the game. I mean, he really, it was his idea. And so that he's like got this unimpeachable authority at all times, which then expresses itself in all these interesting ways that I think actually, I think Rob McElhenney does a great job of playing this character and like making him both sympathetic and unsympathetic, considering that that person in real life is so often the source of so many problems as we've come to learn.
Well, that person in real life can also be both sympathetic and unsympathetic.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly. That's why it's a good performance. Yes.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant portrayal. Yeah. And the whole first season kind of explores. It's interesting. His character really evolves from the first season through the end of the second season. And the first season explores him as this kind of ultimately like, or toxic masculinity, like macho, like get obsesses over this guy who turns out to be taller than him and spends an entire episode like getting fixated over like bench pressing and like his war wounds and all this other stuff. Tall Paul, I think is the guy's name.
Yeah.
And it's kind
I
of like
about that. So good.
it just feels very real, even though you're watching this fictional show, which all the best fictional shows do. Like it has such an undercurrent of truth to it. But it also explores like him as this guy who is this genius designer and comes up with these ideas that people loved. In the very first episode, it's is about this conflict of like a shovel and Poppy, the other lead character who has some issues of her own, pitches this as like this creative thing. And Ian is like, no, you have to kill people with it. And of course, the audience as kind of crystallized by, as exemplified by PewDiePie, the 10-year-old streamer, they have no interest in the shovel when you can
Pootie Shoe. I was like,
Pootie Shoe. Yes, sorry.
Is it PewDiePie? That's pretty close to
a real
guy. Pootie Shoe.
No, Pootie Shoe.
Pootie Pie would have been pretty funny.
Pootie Shoe, yes. Pootie Shoe, who rates games by the number of buttholes. This is a 4 buttholes. But he and the audience, as a result, don't like the shovel until Ian's idea is executed, and it turns out it's like you can use it to decapitate people. So this show is portraying Ian as this guy who is like a complete mess of a director and terrible boss, asshole in every way, but also a genius, which is kind of that curse that we've all had to deal with at some point or another. Think about at some point or another, the genius asshole, right?
Yeah. Like that. I sort of wonder if maybe that is a problem with the show, though, to depict him as ultimately being right so often, because he's also abusing his employees in a funny way.
Well, but that's what's interesting about season 2, and we can get to that, but that's what changes in season 2, and I think season 2 is like so much better in part because of that.
Yeah, although I think actually things start to change with both the quarantine episode and the Everlight episode, because those are the episodes where, so the quarantine episode is mainly about Poppy having a breakdown and Ian coming to her as a friend rather than a boss. And this is like them starting to have more of an equal relationship and the tension between the two of them trying to run the studio together, which is functionally impossible. I mean, there's also just the fantasy of a woman rising up the ranks as like the most esteemed programmer in her field. Like that's literally never happened in video games, but it's a fantasy that I'm willing to go along with because I would love for it to be the case. So I just like Poppy as a character as, you know, as damaged and wonderful as she is, I just like that she exists. So I'm like, okay, I'll go along with that. And then the idea that Ian sort of puts aside his own ego and is like, I'm going to be there for Poppy in that moment, I think is like the beginning of a more interesting arc for him of just putting aside his ego in general. And Everlight is more funny than not, but it is also the two of them figuring out how to be bosses as opposed to just the cool kids at work. And that tension between like running the LARP, getting to be the royal figures that everybody looks up to. And then like they do save the day at the end, but they are also like, we don't really know how to be managers and we don't know how to be professional. And I don't know. It's tough because I'm like, it's a really funny show, but it's also a horrifying thing that is actually mm-hmm. happening at many creative industries everywhere, where I'm like, wow, there are a lot of people who actually don't know how to be bosses and did just have a really cool video game idea or movie idea or whatever, comic idea. And now they're in charge of 300 people or 500 people and they don't really know how to do that. Because that's actually not the same thing as having the really cool video game idea.
No, turns out.
Yeah.
I think that arc that you're both describing of the show basically changing its view of Ion halfway through, or at least halfway through its current run, is super interesting because it does kind of mirror the way that television has changed over the last 20 years. Like, so McElhaney and Megan Gantz and Charlie Day, the creators of this show, all come from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is very much the 2000s era of TV. This is like, along with Arrested Development, these are the shows where the main characters are assholes. Like, Ion would have totally been just the jerk that he is at the very beginning. The guy in that video, my God, I rewatched the first episode and it's this video that's like kind of about how good the game is, but it's really about how awesome he is. And it ends with him like shirtless.
Yeah. And it was also the trailer, which I think was at E3, right? Okay. Like they played that as a trailer, as though it was a trailer for a real video game, which was like a very fun way to promote the show. But it is ludicrous. I mean, it's making fun of E3 trailers and how like ostentatiously they point all the fingers at the auteur figure. I mean, that is what Ion is a parody.
One of the funniest things he says in that video is he's like, people talk about the great art, you know, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. I'm sure you both know this too, but this is a rampant thing in video games that literally every creative person's like whole frame of reference is it like Star Wars? Which is like, I don't even mean that to come off as whatever, because I like Star Wars too, but it's totally a thing. And that was one of the funniest lines.
We've got plenty of episodes we've recorded about Star Wars. People know this. They can go back and listen to that. But also, there's some other stuff.
It's like when you think about the greats, Spielberg.
We should actually do a Beanscast about Lord of the Rings, but anyway.
Anyway, so that character, the shirtless asshole at the end of that trailer, could have totally just been the lead, and it could have been this much more kind of bitter show about that. But if you look at the way the TV kind of changed, like Schitt's Creek is a great example of this, actually, where this show started out kind of like Arrested Development, and in the first season wasn't that great because they're all kind of jerks. And then over the course of the show, it like morphs until they actually are like these loving people who are really there for each other, and that's what the show really came to be. And now we have like shows like Ted Lasso, which is like,
it starts that way and it stays that way. Yeah.
The new frequency. And this show has been interesting because it is sort of performing that feat. Like, there is that change that really sticks out in that quarantine episode where Poppy's having this like genuine breakdown, and it's really heartbreaking. I actually watched that episode after watching season two, which was a really weird place to watch it, because season two is then kind of about their relationship falling apart, and then they sort of build it back up and try something new at the end. But it really is like, there's a lot of really harsh conflict between Poppy and Ion. But in that one moment when he shows up and he's really there for her, it was like really moving, and it really clearly, seeing it there at the end of season two, it really clearly was this fulcrum point where it's like, okay, we can't just have this guy be the toxic leader that exists so commonly in the real world, because we're making a TV show and we want this to be entertaining. We want him to be a more interesting character than that. And I do think they did a good job with that in season two.
He needs to change. He needs to grow. He needs to admit he's wrong sometimes, or else it just becomes annoying to watch, where you're just like, I don't want to watch this guy. I don't want to spend time with this guy anymore. But yeah, I don't know. I thought that was cool. I mainly just liked how much characterization CW got in the second season. I guess I'm skipping ahead here, but I was really surprised by that one shot episode. I think you described it on the show, Jason, but I was just spacing out at the time because I hadn't seen it yet. So it was still a surprise for me, because I just wasn't expecting to even have any sympathies for C.W. Longbottom at all, because the whole point of his character is that he's like the old timer.
He's a time constantly time capsule.
Says like racist stuff, like casually or sexist stuff. Because
such
it's
an
like,
amazing just, speaking voice, though. I love his voice. I could listen to him say horrible things forever.
It's, but it's like, God, who hasn't worked with like a version of that person where you're like, what? Mm-hmm. You need to, someone needs to explain to this guy that like no one talks like that anymore, and like you can't keep doing that.
He's very
that.
Much the office boomer.
Yeah, yeah. The office boomer. Yeah. Although I guess he's like maybe even older than that. I don't know. Maybe he's a boomer. I can't do math.
I think he's a boomer.
But anyway, they do like a flashback episode about how he came to be the person that he is. And it's heartwarming almost, because it's like, oh, this is a guy who saw the potential of what video games could be, but just didn't actually have a way to write them or envision them or explain what they could be to other people in this time period. So instead, he was just writing kind of bad fantasy novels, and also debatively, I don't want to say he plagiarized an Asimov novel.
Plagiarized
that
permission.
Situation was so bizarre, but yeah, plagiarized with permission. I guess we can put it that way. But didn't succeed on his own merits, but then ultimately did succeed on his own merits in a completely different field, but also is still kind of a sexist asshole. So like, I don't know.
And kind of a hack.
Sort of. I mean, you could also make the case that like that this the show is trying to say that like the highest quality for video games is like the subpar fantasy.
I mean, that's kind of interesting though. I was like, it's the same sort of bittersweet knife's edge that the show's constantly walking on, where it's like video games are kind of dumb, right? But like they're also awesome. And I can get on board for something that laughs at games just enough. I mean, I think maybe like the fact that there's a lot of, I mean, Ashley Birch wrote a bunch of episodes for this season. So like you have people on board who are very familiar with games and also how stupid they can be. Like, I think the episode in the first season where CW was like lecturing the testers about cutscenes in games and like how powerful they can be is like another
like watching
striking
Red Dead Redemption
moment.
2,
watching the horse,
just the dumbest thing you've ever seen. I mean, in the context of the game, it's very meaningful, but like context of a television show, you're like, this might be really dumb.
It's nice to see CW get his moment of redemption and bonding with his old friend again. Don't know like how justified that was, but the thing that I really enjoyed about the CW stuff is just that it really helps Ashley Birch's character like come into her own and become, she became like the way they morphed her at the beginning of season two into this like harpy-esque caricature where she's just constantly like getting on everybody's nerves. It was kind of grating, but then they turn her into this like great, they have her evolve and they have a relationship with Dina evolve in some interesting ways, and then she like ultimately becomes a writer or wants to become a writer as a result of C.W. Longbottom, which I think is really cool and interesting. And you can kind of see this transfer in like from the generation of like constant racist sexism stuff to like this younger woman who's a little bit more with it. She's queer, she's got a different perspective, and I think that's cool. Even as much as I could have done with like a little bit like 20% less of like the stereotypical just like shrieking all the time, it was cool to see her have her arc.
I liked that they kept putting her in one-on-one situations with like the senior male characters and bouncing them off of her. I think Ashley Birch rules. We had her on Split Screen.
Yes, friend of the show.
It'd be really fun to have her back on Triple Click.
Yeah, we should have her come
about,
back.
To talk about this show. I would love to know more about
Kirk. The scene with her and Ian was like one of my favorites in the show, because it really showed how like the two of them, they're kind of crossing paths of their arcs, where Ian is like finally like trying to do something good, and like what's her name, Rachel cannot seem to realize it, and then it finally clicks later, and then that was a really cool sequence, I thought.
In the car
in the car where like Ian is like, this is your time, like now is your time.
Thought you meant the other scene with them where he's like forcing her to be his poppy stand-in, which I also thought was a very interesting scene in like the art room. I mean, there's also like the way that the artists are treated on this show is like its own bittersweet, hilarious, dark thing where just like Ian's constantly making the artists create weird shit for him and then being like, yeah, I'm not going to use any of that. But yeah, there is also this moment where he's like trying to get Rachel to like perform for him, which is, I don't know. I mean, it's, again, it's like doing this thing this show does where it's funny, but I'm like, this is a little too real. Like, how many times have like women been put in this position with men who are above them on the hierarchy where they have to like perform a certain role to like please them? I don't know. But Rachel is a character who often calls that out, which is like something you could never really do in that situation. And it's why it's so cathartic to watch something like this, because you're like, well, because Ashley Birch is going to write these amazing one-liners and like then have her character get into this cool writing program. So like, you know, she's going to be okay in the end. So there is still like the wish fulfillment side of it where like things work out on this show in a way that you kind of wish they could in real life, you know?
Yeah,
no, I think it's, I mean, the show is very much a safe space, and not to use that in like the overused way that it's used, but just that like it's a creative space. It's a safe place to express some of these thoughts and to place these characters in a workplace that could be very complicated and very charged and difficult in the real world. But like you said, Maddie, I mean, it's a TV show. Like, it's their characters. Like, it's designed to explore some of these ideas, but in the context of a comedy, so it's like always pretty light. But it does explore the ideas. So yeah, Jason, I was gonna call out that scene in the car with Ian and Rachel because I thought it was really interesting. It was like a pretty barbed conversation where he basically says to her, well, what would you want to do if you wanted to do something, you know, if you wanted more responsibility? And she doesn't really have an answer. And he, like you said, he kind of blows up at her. He's like, well, you need to have an answer. Like, he's like, this is like the moment where you're with the creative director on the game and he's asking you, what do you want to do? And yet, I don't even know if this is expressed, but it's basically like, do you even understand, though, that for me to think in that way, to think about having a ready answer when the creative director asks me what I want, even that is like outside of my realm of experience. And like, isn't something that you could expect of me? So like,
but like Ian was in that position in the elevator and of course had a ready answer because he was like socialized to be told he should always have the ready answer. Whereas like Rachel's character is not even, she can't imagine that. And that is, and she has to take more time, which I actually like that they eventually have her come to the answer because that's a cooler arc for her to be like, okay, like I was in that, I had the opportunity to give my pitch and I didn't even know what it should be, but let me figure out what it's going to be. And that's cool too.
And so when I say the show is like a safety, a safe feeling, it gives me a kind of a safe feeling. That's kind of what I mean. It's that they'll bring these things up and then they'll conclude them. Like they'll bring them back. Where in real life, that situation, it might be that you had that shot at some job
and you never
and
get
you
it
blew
again.
It and you never even it. Really knew it, and then maybe 10 years later somehow you it dawns on you that you like, had a shot to do that and you blew it because you didn't, you know, because you were in her position. Where on the show they can explore it and then they can also carry on because there's a pretty small cast and it's this little, it's not actually the size of a game studio and everyone is kind of interacting all the time and they can just like give you closure on things like that and have them actually evolve in like meaningful written
the
ways.
The testers are somehow constantly in meetings.
Well, though, and he's like, why are the testers here?
I know. I feel like they kind of made fun of that in the like the HR episode where Carol was making everybody fill out their packets about the which animal represented their personality because it was like every person at the studio, like unspecified number of people has filled it out other than like the seven main characters of the show for each of their own stupid reasons. And like that almost reminded me of like Community, how like there are those episodes of Community where like you briefly see the lens of like how the rest of the school perceives the study group and like how annoying and self-absorbed all of them are. And like it kind of felt that it felt like a microcosm of that on this show where
Megan
like,
Gantz of course
was a writer in Community
there's a big DNA crossover you can do an almost one-to-one character like comparison between Community and Mythic Quest if you want to like
and yet Danny Pudi is not playing the same character
it's true
he gets to do so much different stuff on this show I really liked how he got a lot more to do this season as well.
He's having like,
He's having a great time. I feel like he's really growing into the antagonist role that he already had, but like as of the Everlight episode, just like fully went villain mode in such a deep, fun way that I was just like, okay, he's just gonna be like I don't even know, dark devil guy. Like, I don't even know what he turned into at the end.
Right, well, like elf. The forces of the market. He's like every cynical thing that people, that gamers like imagine yes. studio people are doing. Like, he is yeah. the embodiment of that. Like, oh no, let's right. only do this thing. Like, let's create this terrible loot box so that we can get money from people. Like, let's only put this in the game if it makes money. Let's exploit everyone, everything we can. Like, he's like kind of capitalism personified.
Let's make a mobile game that is yeah. just complete garbage, and like mm-hmm. anything meaningful that it might say is going to be completely stripped away and replaced with microtransactions. I mean, that's all accurate, though, as far as I know. So I actually think that's just a one-to-one portrayal.
Yeah, I feel like there really are people like him. That's, yeah, that's I think what's, what's might nuts be. Is that there are people like every single person in that studio, there are people like that in the right. games industry.
And mm-hmm. what's cool about the studio is they've invented it, is they've imagined it, is that each of those people is really like 10 people at a studio.
Right. Yes.
And every one of those meetings has five times as many people in it, but they've mm-hmm. managed to distill each of those roles very effectively down to one person. I think it's actually really interesting that it matches up so well with the character archetypes in a show like Community. And I'm guessing you could probably like go back to Cheers or something and do this where like every sitcom
the TV has like
the different yeah. archetypes, but like that it also kind of maps onto a workplace in a way that, though none of us have worked in game development, I think does feel remarkably true to what I understand of game studios. I think that's really cool that it this microcosm of what we understand as a bigger studio still feels believable as a game studio, even though it's like two testers, one biz dev guy, like one producer, you know,
one community manager, one yeah, HR one lead programmer. Person. Yeah. yeah.
Oh man, the poor community manager.
Oh geez, yeah.
Sue, so, yeah, she, yeah, she's incredible.
Her basement office and her death threats. And the Nazis, oh man.
Yeah.
it's bizarre. I've seen a lot of game developers over the past 2 years since the show has been on say, like on Twitter, I can't watch this. Like, I tried watching this and could never watch it again.
Because I could totally really, see that. Yeah.
It really mm-hmm. strikes a chord if you've been through some of this stuff. Like, if you've ever been attacked by Nazis on the internet, like I was for, have been, and still have been for the yeah, greater geez. Part of a week now, it's really nuts how true a lot of this stuff feels. And that's for better and for worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like it almost hit that for me in season one in a way that season two didn't quite. Like, season one, they were so much more focused on the ins and outs of making the game and like mm-hmm. the streamers and how they react to the game. And like, there was this whole plot line where Dana became a streamer, but she was like actually still technically working for the company. And like, that was controversial. And it just felt like something that wouldn't quite happen to me. But, and the things about them making the game that weren't accurate stood out to me more because mm-hmm. so much of the show was about the machinations of making the game and like plot points hinged on that in a core way. Whereas season two, it just felt like they were making a show about people. Like, it was a workplace right. comedy. It's still about, they happen to be making a game and there's still aspects of it. Like, you know, Danny Pudi's character, like caring about microtransactions and the business of the game and so on. Uh-huh. Like, it's still part
the Battle
of it.
Royale.
But they, yeah, like whether or not the game should be Battle Royale, which is, it's, yeah, that's, it's very funny to imagine like Poppy just coming in one day and being like, it's a Battle Royale now. And uh-huh. like having that uh-huh. be the extent of the programming that she has to do. I mean,
well, hey, I mean, we were talking about Metaverse.
Yeah.
The other day.
We're talking about Fortnite recently.
Yeah, Mythic Quest is very much a Metaverse.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Best
it
part,
is.
By the way, the best games part of the whole show is at the near the end of season two when Ian and Poppy are both showing off their respective versions of the expansion. Ian is like, yes. This is Zeus, and then it's just a bunch of random ass video games, and yes. it's not even coherent. It's just like, here's Assassin's Creed, here's Horizon Zero Dawn, here's yeah. like a cinematic from Diablo.
Here's a character fighting another character from a completely different game. Yeah.
It's just complete random nonsense.
Yeah, there's a lot of Diablo in season two. That's right.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of glad that like at first it seemed like people were blown away, but then they kind of acknowledge like Ian is like, my thing is garbage. Like, it wasn't even good. And so I'm kind of glad they acknowledge that a little bit, because what he showed really made no sense at all. But it was funny.
I mean, I don't even think they bothered to write out like something that Zeus was. Like, they just sort of posed right. it as a stereotypical, like, it's going to be a quest where you kill a guy and right. don't even worry about it. Like, it's just the most rote possible raid. And then Poppy's thing is, like, creating The Sims in World of uh-huh. Warcraft and, yeah. like, having it be instances of The Sims that populate on every single person's map, which would be mm-hmm. completely impossible. And even I know that. So having right. that be the plot point, again, it just worked a lot better for me than season one did, where, like, because it was vague enough in terms of the technology and also expansive enough that I could be like, yeah, what Poppy's proposing would never work. And I know enough about games to know that. That made it work a lot better for me and allow me to focus on something like the relationship between Poppy and Ian and like the really tense fights that they have. Like the end of the HR episode with the yeah, packet. Man. Was like
I yeah
was
really like, intense
holy shit
like, yeah I didn't see that coming well, I thought it was gonna Poppy, end on a lighter note
me too
I feel like post breakdown Poppy just became such an asshole this season two.
Yes very very self-absorbed version of Poppy yeah
self-absorbed yeah and just like berating I mean even she treats the artist even worse than yes. Ian does like she just berates everybody
she learned it from watching him it's like if you have a terrible boss you don't know how to ever be a good boss right
yeah you just emulate them yeah it's yeah. really interesting and as a character study it's just brilliant but yeah Poppy became a little insufferable this last
man
season.
Though her face yeah. Charlotte Nickdow's face it's I like know. One of the most incredible faces I've ever
she
seen
she has very yeah very good face very expressive
she's
face
she's so funny
just like
too.
A rubber like, face
the part where she gives that speech and oh, it turns yeah, out it's God, all it's written like by Ian
yes. pretty good was Jesus. Crazy
pretty good
this is making me want to rewatch season two yeah I think that shift away from video games it kind of matches with a tonal thing that we were talking about earlier where like the show is making fun of video games and it's never quite doing the like, video games are beautiful and amazing and they're just the best. Similar to how it's also not doing a like, let's really get nitty gritty and show all the cool specific stuff about video games where they edge into that more in season one. The feeling where it feels a little more like you're maybe watching like a YouTube comedy short that someone made that's like super real about video games, but that kind mm-hmm. of is too real about video games. And it's sort of similar to the way that the show is very happy to make fun of video games and be like, you know, whatever. Like you said at the beginning, Maddie, like video games are kind of dumb. Like we all like them, but whatever. And then it just kind of treats the ubiquitousness of video games as like, it takes it for granted. It's like, yeah, we all know what video games are. We're all playing them. So let's just make this show about people who happen to be making them. And at times we'll make observations about them. But like the CW Longbottom flashback, it's a beautiful moment when he sees Pong and it's like this epiphany for him, but they don't overdo it. Like they yeah. never quite overdo it. And then, like you said, he does kind of just go on to become kind of a hack writing this like kind of hacky MMO. And it's yep. not clear whether maybe he'll go on and they'll make some indie game in season three and he'll write the great, you know, some great story or maybe
I mean,
not.
Like,
but like
probably not. I mean, it's
no,
CW,
probably not.
Like...
Right. Because this isn't quite that show. And that's actually really good for it. I think that's good for the tone.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, he was working at a Renaissance fair for
selling chicken, award winning chicken.
Award winning chicken. Yeah, that's true.
I did really like the CW one shot, but it is hard to beat A Dark, Quiet Death from the
yeah.
first season.
I was about to bring that up. Yeah, yeah. I was about to say, let's discuss that. That was the episode that just like blew my fucking pants off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it is the story that shows you the way that something that you made can get away from you, which isn't quite what Mythic Quest as a show is about. And it's almost right. like A Dark, Quiet Death is a different story about a different, I mean, it is a different story about a different game, but it just so happens to have been situated within this show. And yeah. contrasting that with the end of season two, where Poppy and Ian are both kind of like, I guess we're done with Mythic Quest and we've been creatively fulfilled, is it's almost like a more hollow ending compared to what A Dark, Quiet Death was showing, which I think is sadder but closer to the experience a lot of people have when a game becomes that successful, which is like seeing the thing become bigger than you to such a degree that you can't control it anymore and you maybe still kind of want to, but there's nothing you can do about it and you're unable to let go. We're getting deep here.
Mm-hmm. No, it's super true though. I think I've thought about this a lot about how there's not a neat one-to-one between A Dark Quiet Death and Mythic Quest. And I've come to really like that about it. I like that it's very different. I think the ending of season two of Mythic Quest is really just like a reset. It's a chance for them to like have a new setup for season three. But I hear what you're saying. I feel that way too. But it is really interesting that they chose to put this story about a kind of a different thing in the middle of this show and just let it be there. Like, I actually kind of really like that. I think I would have liked it less if it had been a really obvious parallel.
Yeah.
Where there are some aspects that are moving in parallel, but it's really just kind of its own thing. It's just this beautiful little standalone story about exactly what you said, about making something that you then lose control of and how wonderful and sad that is. And I thought that was really cool.
Well, lose control almost makes it seem like passive, when this is a story about just losing control. It's about giving up your control intentionally, or it's about like
a relationship between two people where one person is trying to maintain control and the other person is like making other decisions. And
well, the way Kristen Milioti puts it in the show is like the frog boiling, where you're like slowly letting them turn up the heat and suddenly you're boiling.
Right. And yeah, I don't mean to imply that it was a passive thing. I mean, it obviously wasn't. I just mean like you lose control in this way, like life takes it away from you. It just happens, right? Yes. The way that it happened to them is really believable.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, but the point, I mean, I think that it raises interesting questions, and I certainly think anyone who's in that sort of situation where you like have made something and you're trying to decide whether to sell it and whether to give up your rights, you watch that episode, I certainly think it'll make you think twice, or at least give you some pause, because you very much have a choice in the situation if you're in a situation like Dark Quiet Death's creators were.
I think, do you think that we're maybe at the sort of beginning or at the beginning middle of a sort of era of people who really understand that? Like, I think about this with Triple Click, right? Like, where
we're constantly getting offers from Microsoft.
No,
from
we're
Sony.
Not. But the show is growing. And
Jeff
Bezos.
Xbox Game Pass.
Keep
That's
calling
our new
us.
Future.
People used to make things that would then grow and then you would sell them. And that was like a just totally expected trajectory.
Yep.
And I don't think that any of us want that for Triple Click. And I think a lot about how that totally happens to people who do things. You know, it's not that much like Triple Click, but it's the closest thing I've ever done that's to that. So that's kind of my point of comparison. But it used to be people would just do that all the time. And I think a whole generation of people, kind of like Gen Xers mostly, like did that and then learned the lessons that I think are so beautifully reflected in A Dark Quiet Death in that episode. And now there's kind of a new generation of people. And I think there are a lot of people like us who are much more aware of what it really costs you to maybe get some payday for something that you made, but also to lose control of it, and like how that can just change your whole life in all of these ways that you didn't anticipate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Throughout that whole episode, the dude, what's his name? It's the Jake Johnson character.
Doc Michael.
Mm-hmm. So he's always talking about like five different times he's like, but this will make us sell so many more copies. This will help us sell so many more copies. But there's never a discussion of like, why do we need to sell more copies? Like, aren't we perfectly happy reaching the 300,000 people or whatever who bought this first thing? And there's always just the expectation of growth. And that to me is like more the truest thing about the video game industry that this show captures at all, is like that constant expectation. Like, one thing that's never really mentioned about Mythic Quest is like subscriber numbers or revenue numbers. And like, there's talk in the abstract about like, oh my god, this microtransaction is going to sell so much, this battle royale mode is going to make us so much money,
or we're getting so many new subscribers from the battle royale. Like, they sort of mention it in passing,
but there's never like, hey, we didn't hit our KPIs, hey, our revenue targets are down this month. And I think that is really interesting. I would love to see season three explore that a little more. But in Dark Quiet Death,
I could see
them
doing it too with Danny Pooh's character. Well, like, I could see him getting in and being like, we're not hitting our targets and we need to like change everything.
Yeah, how are we gonna optimize this? Yep. Yeah. Ship more products. Yeah. Do a full on Activision takeover thing. But but that's the conversation that like a healthy relationship would have led to, which is like, why do we need to be selling more? Why do we need to reach more eyeballs? Right. Why are we not content with just sustainable like numbers instead of constant growth?
It was like the key thing that Doc and Bean did not communicate on. And it was like right at the moment where their relationship was kind of falling apart, and they didn't have that conversation, which, as it turns out, is a really important one.
Yeah.
And just the creative integrity aspect of it. I mean, I think the piece of it that Mythic Quest also hasn't gotten into, but that we're more familiar with Triple Click, and that I think a lot of people are familiar with if they're in any type of creative job, is like, the idea of creating something where you're already part of a company, and like when Dana and Rachel are creating their game for Mythic Quest, their version of Grouchy Goat, and then it gets canned immediately because it's like not what it's supposed to be. And the fact that like they can spend so much time on this and then be like, oh, right, like we don't actually get to make the call about whether or not this continues. Like, we don't own this, in much the same way that the three of us did not own Kotaku Split Screen. We could not control what happened to it. But like, that meant that then when we made this show, we were like, we want to own this one. We went into this and we were like, we want the name Triple Click. We want to own everything about it. Like, we will work with Max Fun because they'll let us do that. And that was the thing we cared about more than anything else, which is like, A Dark Quiet Death is kind of about that, but I feel like Mythic Quest as a show, it hasn't quite reached that. And I hope that in season three they do, because like that final dinner conversation between Poppy and Ian, where Ian was like, great, so like, what's your next idea? I was just like, so are the two of them supposed to just go and make another successful game now? Because I can't really see that for them. And like, I don't know if the two of them should even be working together at all. It seems more just like they were thrust together by circumstance as opposed to actually being simpatico. And that's interesting.
They both make each other worse, which...
Yeah, I mean, that could be true.
Which is good for a TV show and drama and conflict, but not so good for actual creative endeavors. Yeah, we haven't seen many reactions other than the shovel, which in the universe of this game, let's accept as an awesome thing.
Yeah.
Other than the shovel, we haven't seen any real examples of Poppy and Ian teaming up on something that turned out to be great. And that, I think...
And is Ian going to be willing to play second fiddle to Poppy's idea?
Well, that'll be the whole core conflict of season three, I'm sure. Like, that's the whole thing. But I think that is one thing that the show is lacking, is that it really hasn't sold us on like why these two have so much respect for each other, or like why they are supposed to or ostensibly do.
Yeah, it's kind of always the challenge with shows like this, like the deal with Hacks, where the jokes were never that great, or Studio 60, where like the skits were always pretty second rate. Like, if you're making a show about creative people who are making a product,
it's
like
hard.
You have to convince people that it's going to be great, where really Mythic Quest, the game, is kind of just a running joke, where it's just anybody who's played video games, which is millions and millions of people watching the show. So pretty much everyone watching the show gets that when they show a random cutscene from For Honor or something, like, it's not supposed to make any sense. You're not thinking that this is some great game. It's just, well, I mean, some people think For Honor is a great game, but I mean, but that it's not Mythic Quest is not some great game.
According to Kirk, it's terrible. So keep that in mind.
That's really the takeaway here. No, I've actually never played For Honor. I hear it's very fun.
The clips are pretty good as like pacing, because the show doesn't have commercials, and it's weird for a sitcom to not have commercials,
right,
so it's
they
nice
need
to have
breaks.
Those little interstitials.
But there's the thing where, like, you don't ever, like you said, you don't ever get a sense that, like, they're making an actually good game, even though they tell you it's successful. They never show you, like, a thing where I watch it and I'm like, oh, that looks fun. Whenever they're showing gameplay, it looks terrible.
It looks terrible,
like,
yeah.
That looks like something from 2002.
But they all act like, I'm assuming that within the fiction of the show that it's supposed to be this awesome thing, because they all act like it is. Yeah. Like, Dana is addicted to the game and like talking about how amazing it is constantly. It just looks like a terrible World of Warcraft knockoff from like the mid-2000s. But I guess you're supposed to accept that this is great within this mythos.
Mm-hmm. That'll be, I think, maybe more of a challenge for them in season three if they need to show a new game that they're making, because we're gonna have to believe
and like envisioning new games. Especially because I feel like, I mean, if they even have a season three, I guess we're just making a lot of assumptions here, but
no,
why
they
not
are. They've announced
great so I don't see I don't even know I was wondering, like, are they gonna split up everyone, because obviously Rachel got into a writing program and clearly has her own designs on what she wants to do.
I take that back, there are no plans just yet.
Got it. Because I feel like this could have been a stopping point at the end of season two.
That's a good point.
Like, everybody's kind of completed an arc of sorts. Mythic Quest itself, apparently, Ian and Poppy are stepping away from the game entirely. David is just screwed, I guess, because he has, like, nowhere he can go. He's
well,
a
that's
fascinating
one
character
who,
too.
Yeah, man, I mean, he's just the punching bag.
He is, but I also feel like he, too, is representative of, like, the classic ineffectual manager who is, like, technically the boss of the auteur figure, but, like, doesn't actually have the means to control them and also doesn't give a shit for some reason, seemingly. And like, mm-hmm. I don't know. That also, I was just like, if this is what video games are like, it explains a lot. If David, yeah, I mean, no,
the pushover. I think a lot of people have certainly had a pushover boss or experience, like had been around someone who is a pushover in that way. Who people just steamrolled constantly. Yeah, it's sad to see. And yeah, I wonder what he's gonna do without Ian and Poppy. Maybe he'll step up to the plate.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's such an ensemble show. I mean, the joy of the show is really just watching all of these different archetypes bounce off of one another, that I have to think they're gonna in some way get everybody back and under the same roof or like working together. Like, I just can't see it, you know. They're not gonna have like Poppy and Ian go off and they're just totally doing something separate.
No, they'll recruit everybody, they'll poach, yeah, they'll poach all,
or they'll need to like work with the publisher for something.
Well, they need a writer, and so Ashley Birch is a writer,
right? Yeah, they're like gonna use their facilities downstairs, and there will be like crossover. There's gonna be some way to keep all these characters together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Or like Joe's character will just take over the entirety of Mythic Quest and like turn it into just this terrifying.
That does feel like it's going to happen. Joe's a great character.
She is.
I kind of saw her going in a different direction in season two. There's the kind of moment where it seems like she's going to become good. And
no.
And then she does not. And I was glad. I was definitely glad for that.
No, Joe is never going to become good. I am glad that they've just committed fully to Joe and Brad both being antagonistic characters, but in different ways, and just constantly trying to one-up each other. There also just aren't enough female villains in fiction anyway who are interesting, and so Joe being just like a straight-up sociopath is funny to me, and it's also terrifying. Like, you would never
Jesse Ennis, who plays her, is amazing. But, like, her presence is amazing.
I mean, she's like incredible. A cartoon. I guess all the characters are cartoony, but she is like the least true. That I don't think there are a lot of actual employees at companies who are like Joe.
I don't know, though, because like,
maybe I could be wrong. If someone's out there is listening and they're like, hey, at my game studio, we have Joe, the sociopath.
I think if you're
a sociopath at a video game studio, you're hiding it. You're not like outwardly sociopathic. Like, most people who are sociopaths are charming.
Well, that's true. That's the cartoon part you're describing. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Most people who are sociopaths are more like Ian, where they're like charismatic and charming.
Right, exactly. But I feel like the part of it, mostly in season one, I was really impressed by the fact that like she was an internet troll, because I feel like people always assume internet trolls are guys, and they're definitely not. Like, there are definitely women who like have are mean. Like, it
Maddie,
is
do you
thing.
Have something to tell us about
yeah,
your
so
industry?
I'm coming clean. I'm an internet troll. But I remember being kind of impressed by that. Like, there are several things this show does that impresses me when it comes to the diversity of the ways that characters can be mean, and like how their life experience is reflected in their meanness, it's almost like the anti Ted Lasso in a way, where it's like, it's instead of having this diverse cast of people who all realize they can be kind to each other, Mythic Quest is like a diverse cast that all like finds new ways to be petty to one another and like take each other down because they're gamers.
So that's the thing. It's funny. That's why my wife Amanda hated this show. I made her watch the whole thing with me, and she hated it because everybody was just like a hateful, spiteful character. And they all seem to hate each other.
Yeah.
And she tends to like dislike, although I guess she did enjoy Always Sunny, but she tends to dislike, she's like, we're watching White Lotus and she dislikes
that.
Don't
you guys watch Succession though?
Yeah, she doesn't like it. And I love Succession. I'm like, man, this is one of my favorite shows, and she doesn't like it. So she in general doesn't like shows where everyone is just a hateful, like terrible person.
Well, Dana isn't.
I wouldn't go that far describing these characters at all.
Sure, for the most
she's
part.
The only healer at the LARP, which I feel like is the greatest encapsulation
so
of
funny.
Dana
that
as
a great
character.
Joke. Yes.
It's incredible. Like,
but yeah, but even Dana, like her naivete, at least in season one, could really get on the nerves. But anyway, the point that I was making was that like there's a certain, despite how true so much of it feels, there's also like none of these people would really, like they all would have quit by now. Like, none of these people would really be working together for this long. And that sort of thing, like they all hate each other so much that it doesn't really feel like they would have, it feels like a bunch of them would have like asked for transfers to different teams or like been elsewhere. And so that part of it doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, like the character relationships, I feel like. But yeah, it is what it is.
I mean, that's how you get that bottle episode, the Breakfast Club episode, where they're all trapped together by HR, and they have to have it
they
out.
They all have to sign their paper.
But they don't actually resolve, like, other than Poppy and Ian, who get their mm-hmm. resolution at the end. There's no reason to believe that, like other than a few pairings, I don't really buy that most of these people get along or would work together at all. This game should have never shipped, in other words.
Yeah, like there were certainly some moments where I would like turn to Dina and be like, Carol would have quit by now. Like there's just no yes. way. Like
especially
Carol.
Because Carol's like, the Carol one can do sane better, character.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
Like,
yeah.
Carol She's is the character who like has other skills. Woman, yeah. Like she could go somewhere else. But David, I don't know if he can go anywhere else. He might be stuck with right. his job. He's failed That's upwards true. So far that this is as good as he can do. And
That's true.
Yeah,
that's very true to life. Is like the white dude. Well, the white dude who was terrible at his job,
yes.
managing to get the highest rank at the company yeah. for years and years,
where everybody's like looking at him and they're like, "How are you even in charge of this? Uh-huh. Like, how did you get this job?"
And he's evidently not from the very beginning, and no one takes him seriously, even though he's like technically a senior, which is a good running joke.
Yeah, yeah. Any other characters or favorite episodes? I guess we haven't really talked about Dana and Rachel's love story yet. I love it, obviously, because I'm a cornball.
Yeah, it's super sweet. Well, I really think, I mean, I've said this before, but I really love that this show is like, it just feels to me like Ashley Birch just doing her thing in a way that many, many, many people will watch, which I know her YouTube videos had a lot of views. And, you know, yeah. that Kotaku split screen episode she was on had like many
tons of downloads,
many
billions.
Thousands of downloads. But
that's
no, but
mainly
really,
what
like,
people know her from, I think.
Yes,
really.
Like, oh,
episode.
From Kotaku's full screen. yep. No, but she's so good. It's so cool that she's so evidently creatively involved in the show, because I was going back, because I was kind of explaining who she was to Emily, and we were watching some old Hey Ash, What She Play in videos, some yes. of the really old ones, and then some of the newer stuff she did for like the IGF. And she just has such a great knack for not just video game humor, but for just comedy. Like, those videos are so funny, those really old ones. And it's yeah. just awesome to see her, like, totally arriving and then being great. I mean, even in the very first episode, which I just rewatched, she has the scene where she's talking to Carol and, like, delivering the love monologue to Dana. And it's like, she's a great actor. Like, she just is, like, great mm-hmm. on screen and so funny and such a good writer. And it makes me really happy to see her get to do that while also playing this like really cool character and like mm-hmm. representing this like lovely little romantic love story. And it's great. Like, it really, like, it makes me so happy that she's in the show. She elevates the show so much in so yep. many ways.
Yeah, yeah, it is really 100%. Cool, especially since I feel like there are very few examples of somebody where I'm like, they got their start on YouTube, and I'm so excited yeah. to see them in a television show now. Mm-hmm. But, like, she truly is that example. Like, I remember watching those YouTube videos. Also, at the time, I was like, wow, there's, like, no female gamers in media ever. And, like, the fact that Ashley Birch was, like, a female YouTuber making funny videos about how she played video games. And the fact that she was a woman is, like, not a part of the joke. Like, she wrote other jokes. That's not to say I don't like Felicia Day's The Guild. Of course I watched it and I enjoyed yeah. it. But, like, you know, that's a big part of how that show operates. It's still, mm-hmm. you know, I haven't watched it in years. Nobody quiz me about whether it's still funny. I don't know. It might be bad. But I remember, like, Hey Ash, what's playing meant a lot to me at the time. Mm-hmm. And it's like pretty wild to see her trajectory now, where it's like she's Aloy in Horizon Zero Dawn, and yeah. also she's like writing this television show and on it, and it rules. I don't know. It's just cool. Mm-hmm. It's like seeing somebody make good on something that they deserve for mm-hmm. years
yeah,
and years.
It gives me a lot of trust in the show, I guess.
Local like, girl makes good.
Yeah, local girl in the sense that she's local to the town of video games.
No, she's local. She's local to Kotaku split screen.
That's true. So
right,
true.
Right. Really, her launching pad. You know.
Oh my god. Anyway, I liked her. I liked her and Dana's relationship. Again, mm-hmm. it doesn't really have to do with like games. It just felt like a true representation of people learning how to communicate with one another, two very different personality mm-hmm. types figuring out how to date. Lots of comedy potential there that is just pure and enjoyable to watch. Carol having to put up with it was very funny to me in just a base way, even though you would never want that to happen in a real office. Still very funny. And I liked it. I thought it was well written.
Yeah, it's a good example of like how TV writers have learned that successful relationships can still be very funny and interesting. Like that yeah. you don't have to have the humor and the drama come from, you know, outside forces breaking them up or failures to communicate, like in that old school way of just like someone could
someone
have just told the other
tell
person
you
something
and, for no right, reason. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is so frustrating. And so the way that shows used to work, then there was that kind of turn. You're like, I feel like Friday Night Lights, where, you know, the marriage at the center of that show was just never in question. And it was fine because it was still a really interesting relationship. And like right around then in the sort of early 2000s. And now we're to this point where, yeah, it's just like, it's funny and interesting and cool to just watch a relationship slowly find its groove.
Well, I don't know. It gets into a cliche in season two where like, oh, are we going to have a long distance thing? Oh, are you going to go to college without me? Like, that's the cliche of all
cliches.
Yeah,
though I think that even the way that they handled it was a little bit surprising. Like, it wasn't what you would think a show would do. Like, and that is something that real relationships do have to deal with. So they didn't deal with it.
Cliche
in
for
as,
a reason, I
right,
would say.
In as cliche of a way as they could have.
Yeah.
You're all saying right. real relationships don't have to deal with one person not telling the other that the heart in the calendar actually meant Mr. Heart was coming to dinner. Oh,
yeah, I mean, Wanda Maximoff and the Visions relationship is deeply relatable to us all.
Very,
and
very real.
We all struggle with our robot significant other and or which significant other, depending on which half
what
of it
we are.
What is
this, a crossover episode?
Every time I see a couple, all I'm right. like, are you the witch or the robot? Anyway, enough Marvel talk. I guess we can do final thoughts. Kirk, give me your final thoughts. Would you recommend this show? What'd you think of it? Should people watch it even though they just listened to an hour of us spoiling every single aspect of it?
Yeah, I think they would, because we didn't really get into so many of the jokes, and a lot of the jokes are just really funny. Yeah, I think it's
yeah,
a great show.
So
I totally
good.
Like it.
Yeah, I like it too. What about you, Jason?
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed it, especially the two standalone episodes, which I just thought were tremendous. Dark White Death and then the CW one.
Backstory.
Which,
backstory,
by the way, fun
with an exclamation
fact,
mark.
Yeah, backstory. Fun fact, the first episode of the show, the pilot, I don't know if this is something they added in later, but when they mentioned CW's Nebula, they show a picture of Josh Brenner, young CW.
I didn't know that either until I was looking up all the actors on IMDb, and I was like, wow, they got the same guy
back?
Did
they like Star Wars special edition this? I'm really curious about
that. Yeah, it might be something. The thing is, when it's like on a digital platform, you have no way of knowing if they added it in later. So I don't know.
I feel like the internet knows, but I don't
know. Yeah, maybe. I was looking it up a little.
We're putting
and
it
I
out there in the world. People can tell us if they remember.
I couldn't find an answer. I will say I could not find an answer. But anyway, yeah, I really like the show. Very excited for season three one day. I think Charlie Day and Rob McElhenney and obviously Megan Gantz, I think they're all just such creative powerhouses that that I will watch anything that they all come up with. So good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I don't really know where I could imagine season three going. So if it stops here, I won't be mad at it. And I still think it's worth watching
it
in its entirety. But it would probably have to split up like a show Kirk hasn't seen called Billions, where one of the characters notably leaves the venture capital firm and then you just follow them and you see their firm in addition to the other firms. And so they could pull a Billions. They could pull, I didn't say who it was. They could pull a Billions and just have multiple game studios in the mix that are all competing with one another and interfacing with one another. And I think that could actually be really interesting and fun as well. And also they could get into the drama of like indie studios, which also have their own troubles, of course, just like the Activision Blizzards of the world, sadly. So
yeah, there's no shortage of drama in the games world to borrow from. But what I like about the first two seasons so far is that they haven't taken from real headlines.
Right.
They haven't like aped real stories. At least not yet.
They've like approximated the reality into
it's
something
an amalgam of like real
that's representative
stuff.
And relatable. Without being literally one-to-one ripped from the headlines.
Yeah, I don't know if there needs to be a sexual harassment scandal at Mythic Quest. I think,
no,
they could steer around
not.
That one and it'd be fine.
But I think that the second season, I think I read somewhere that they originally wanted it to be them all going to E3 in the second season, or at least part of the second season was going to be about that. And then the pandemic happened, so they changed around their plans. So yeah, I'm very curious to see what happens with season
that's
three.
That's true. They could have some stuff that they were kind of planning that they put on hold.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely more games world stuff you can explore without necessarily like stealing from the headlines or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But
we'll see. An E3 episode would be fun.
Maybe they'll if they want a triple click cameo, we will be
hit us up,
Mythic Quest.
Polygon and Kotaku got shout outs. Next it's gonna be triple click. True.
Do they want Jason to interview them at E3?
Yeah, that'd be fun.
It would be fun. All right. Nice. Well, thanks again to you, the listener, for supporting Maximum Fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We appreciate you. Thank you so much. And this has been another Beans Cast.
All right. Yes, we will see you all soon.
Yeah, see you both soon.
Bye.
Triple Click is produced by Jason Schreier, Maddie Myers, and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the show and also wrote our theme music. Our show art is by Tom DJ. Some of the games and products we talked about on this episode may have been sent to us for free for review consideration. You can find a link to our ethics policy in the show notes. Triple Click is a proud member of the Maximum Fun Podcast Network, and if you're listening to this bonus episode, it means you're already a member, so thank you. We really appreciate your support. Find us on Twitter at TripleClickPod, send email to tripleclick@maximumfun.org, and find a link to our Discord in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.